Russell Lamberti, CEO of Sakaliga. Thank you so much for your time. We are looking at a couple of different topics today, and I want to start with AGOA and the trade relations that we as South Africa have and the objective for the South African government in international relations, what the overriding objective for the national interest or to meet the national interest is in your from your perspective.
Yeah, hi, Bronwyn. That's a great question. It's a tough question because to speak of national interest means that you've got to try and sort of amalgamate all sorts of kind of competing views on what that means. So that's, of course, a very difficult departure point. But some of the low-hanging fruit there is, you know, be friends with as many people around the world as you can be, and trade with as many trading partners as you can. And that means bigger markets. It means better supply onshore. So that's got to be the objective. We have a US administration now that is seeking to use the kind of tariff stick, as it were, as part of you know, international relations and negotiating tactics and so on. That's a somewhat different landscape that people have to start getting used to, and no doubt that's probably something that's going to escalate globally. I think one just needs to see this as part and parcel of you know, the shifting landscape. This is how one has to kind of engage in these sorts of negotiations. The goal is ultimately to have, on the whole, generally lower tariffs for trade to move more freely. Cheaper goods and services are generally better, and better market access, especially for a small economy like South Africa that needs access to global markets, is absolutely critical. So this kind of escalation in tensions, I don't know where it's all going yet. It's still very, very fluid and very new. This is very new territory for the South African government. But certainly tensions are escalating. The ambassador's been ejected from the United States. What that means in terms of things like AGOA and various trade arrangements and so on is still up in the air. But the objective must be to maintain good relations with large trading partners as far as possible. That's to my mind is kind of a no-brainer.
Can China, just staying with the trade discussion for a little longer, can China make up for any shortfall that we experience with the US? For instance, if we are ejected from AGOA, will our relations with China make up for the shortfall?
Again, I think these are very kind of opaque sort of themes that's not easy to get one's head around. We are a very small economy in this big global ocean. And so it's not like we make up a large portion of trade or anything like that. But in terms of things like AGOA itself is an overestimated kind of risk. It covers a not very large portion of trade. The adjustments there on tariffs, when you break it down into the final sort of analysis, it's maybe single digit billions of rands. That's nothing to be sneezed at, but in an economy that's 7 trillion rand, it starts to kind of put something like AGOA into perspective, Bronwyn. So that's an important thing to say first and foremost. So I don't think that we need to see US trade disappearing. Potentially that we see a bit more friction in South Africa US sort of bilateral trade. And that's something to be concerned about. Particularly, I mean, I think AGOA is perhaps less important than the threat of kind of blanket significant tariffs across all trade flows between South Africa and the United States. I think that's far more concerning. Is it easy just to pivot to other countries? I mean, remember, trade relations are established business connections. This kind of cultural compatibility, English and South Africa and the United States, both English-speaking territories. So it's not easy just to kind of flick the switch off and on again when it comes to global trade. There's big economies out there, but losing good trade flows with the United States is very significant, and certainly not something that you can just kind of pivot. This idea that, well, there's this thing called BRICS, and if America doesn't work, then we sort of turn to BRICS. That's a very shallow analysis of how trade and international relations work. And I'll just make a quick point. A country like India does this so well. India is part of BRICS. It's a good friend of the United States. It manages good relations with its Middle Eastern kind of counterparts. It has traded with Russia, I believe, through this whole period. It's kind of managing relations with China. So they seem to be adopting what I would call mature diplomacy, mature international relations. That's got to be the direction we move in.
One more question is on manufactured goods, exporting manufactured goods versus exporting raw materials. There is the perception that we are more focused on raw materials insofar as our relationship with China, and that the manufactured goods flow to the US. Is that appropriate thinking?
Well, we do send quite a lot of raw mineral goods to the United States. And, you know, again, I think people like to think of trade in these fairly simple narratives. Yes, China needs resources. There's actually nothing wrong with selling resources to someone if you are good at producing resources. South Africa has actually become less efficient at producing resources. But if you do, that's actually fine. There's this idea of beneficiation. You should actually be manufacturing because then you get more for what you sell. But if you're not efficient at manufacturing it, then it just costs you a hell of a lot to make those things that you're trying to sell. So we need to stick, South Africa needs to stick to strengths. Businesses need to sell to as many markets as possible. We need to send raw materials to the US, to China, which we do. We need to send manufactured goods to the US, probably, you know, to China, probably less so to China because they're very competitive in their local market. But I mean, I think, again, it's just this more, we need to have a more mature perspective on what trade is. It's not so much something that gets directed by governments. It's a business-orientated process. Businesses find other businesses to trade with in other countries. And we've got to let that process happen organically and give it as much space as possible to flourish.
Let's talk now about the Government of National Unity and where we are going post the budget furore. The fact that opposition parties still need to sign off the budget, and this could be a long, drawn-out parliamentary process.
Yeah, exactly. And I think for the first time, we're seeing something we haven't seen for ages, which is that the budget is actually up for debate after it gets tabled by the minister in parliament. That's clearly a welcome development. It's concerning that any form of tax increase is being discussed, because what it shows you is that we have what I like to call a special interest budget. We have government departments, favored contractors, and various other beneficiaries of this process that are simply unable and unwilling to take any form of cuts. And so you end up in this quite ridiculous political situation where the state is now trying to put even more taxes onto a heavily taxed population where there's no economic growth. So that this is even in the realm of discussion is highly concerning. Yes, it's good that we've seen pushback from the DA on this VAT story. But a concern I have, I think, in general is the sort of glacial pace at which any kind of reform discussion seem to be taking place. And it's very clear that the ANC, as this kind of senior partner in this government, really has no strong intention to make meaningful moves. That's what the data seems to be presenting. Because if they did, we would be talking about, the discussion would really be around how can we cut this deficit, roughly 300 billion rand a year of new debt that we're going into, which racks up to about a trillion rand over a three-year cycle. How can in year one, how can we halve that deficit or cut a third off of that deficit, take it down to 200 billion In year two, can we take it down to 100 billion? In year three, four, can we balance the budget? I mean, if the discussion is not somewhere in that zone, we're really just kind of fiddling, as far as I'm concerned, Bronwyn. And I think that's my concern. So whether we will get a 0.5% VAT increase, and you know, this is really kind of just fiddling in a conversation that needs to go much more strongly in the right direction. So I hope that there is increasing opposition to this budget to really force a rethink. I suppose a latent concern that one always has in this current arrangement is that in parliamentary terms, the ANC has partners to its left that make up 25% of you know, parliamentary votes. And if they don't get what they want out of their GNU partners, there's the ability to turn that way. So leverage for the junior partners, it's not non-existent, but it's quite limited. And I think that that makes this very tricky for the junior partners in the coalition.
Do you think the coalition will survive?
Such a tough question. It's never totally made sense putting partners together that have such different starting points and ways of seeing the world. So it's from the outset been a very uneasy coalition. And to date, it's not clear to me, Bronwyn, that it's really working for the country. What people who support this coalition, and of course the coalition partners themselves, particularly the DA, like to point to what might have happened had this coalition not been formed, and they talk about a doomsday coalition. There's some validity to that scenario, but that was not the only alternative. The ANC could be governing as a minority party with various arrangements, and you know that the DA could have struck with the ANC around confidence and supply agreement arrangements and so on and so forth. You've seen the federal chair of the DA just in the last day or so lamenting what's going on in this coalition with the potential selection of a new US ambassador, and basically concerned that the ANC is just driving the ship without any consideration for its partners. So there's clearly a huge amount of tension. I don't know whether this holds or not, but I think an important thing is that we mustn't let people argue for the coalition holding by dangling this thing called the doomsday scenario in front of us the whole time. That is not the only other alternative. And it's not obvious that that the ANC wants to go into coalition with those other partners. And so I think just dangling that the whole time, a little bit of a manipulative strategy to say, well, the only possible outcome and scenario here is the present coalition. I don't think that's true. And I think the coalition, the junior partners, especially the DA, really need to think hard about where their leverage lies and how they can start exerting more leverage in this relationship. Because the current trajectory from my vantage point, doesn't seem to be working very well.
Is Steenhuisen the right man to be leading the Democratic Alliance at this time?
Bronwyn, I think that it's got to be very difficult to run a political party that is both a coalition partner in a government, but also a kind of opposition, a parliamentary opposition. I mean, officially it's not because it's now in the government, but it wears both these hats, if you like. And to run a very significant portfolio, which is agriculture. Now, the ANC do this. The leader of the ANC is also the president. And so you might say, well, how does he run his party effectively and run the country? And the answer is he doesn't run his party effectively. And he doesn't run the country very effectively. So wearing these sorts of hats, very, very big hats to wear, a major portfolio in government, managing the coalition dynamics, leading the major coalition partner and essentially the major opposition, the Liberal opposition, to my mind is too many hats to wear. So I think the DA, I think Minister Steenhuisen, have to make some tough choices about how much capacity can be truly given to all these different spheres. And I think that that's very difficult. And I think they need to think really hard about that.
Russell, you say there's an alternative to the doomsday scenario. Can you map that out for me?
Well, Bronwyn, I'm not a political analyst, but certainly there has always been the possibility of the ANC governing as a minority party, the way that would have worked is that the DA could have offered their vote to Mr. Ramaphosa after the election to be the president, but then for that. Or after that, entered into what's known as a confidence and supply agreement or a confidence and supply arrangement, where you will offer your vote for the president if he comes up against votes of no confidence, provided that you're getting X, Y, and Z out of the arrangement. And supply refers to helping the government pass the budget. As a minority party, they need the requisite votes to get the budget over the line. Again, that's always going to be difficult when the DA is only 22% and EFF plus MK is around the same, 25% or so. It would mean lots of jostling. But I think having the ANC govern as a minority party would probably have resulted in a lot more leverage over the ANC, who are currently governing as though they have all the cards, and to some degree they do. They've got all the personnel stacked in these departments. They've got all the know-how from running this driving this ship for 30 years, and they really are kind of strongly in the driver's seat. And their coalition partner, Bronwyn, again, really key, have constantly said that if they leave, we're going to get doomsday. But if you say that, then you've tied yourself into a particular position that's very difficult to exit from. And so from a negotiation and leverage perspective, it's quite limiting.
As a final question, how are you feeling as a South African who's seen a number of cycles, both economic and political? How do you feel at this juncture?
Well, we have this, it feels, and I think people probably are feeling this, Bronwyn, and I get a little bit of the sense of the sand shifting under our feet a little bit. It's a time of tremendous uncertainty. We have an ANC that lost an election, essentially, but it retains this real power over the economy. And I'm concerned that the ANC is feeling desperate, and in its desperation is trying to push a very harmful agenda and accelerate that more. So I think that's part of where uncertainty is coming from. I don't think this is necessarily a real problem on the streets, but certainly in online discourse, you feel this sort of rising sense of perhaps racial animosity and tension and so on. And of course, the United States administration has injected something into that discourse as well. And so the uncertainty is ratcheting up. So I think it's perfectly understandable that people are currently feeling uncertain. I mean, we use that word uncertain, but nervous and kind of out of place. But we are very excited about the agenda that we're pursuing at Sakalicha. We've got big cases up ahead that are winnable against these very, very harmful pieces of legislation, NHI, the Expropriation Act, the Climate Change Act, and various other things that are rolling through. The employment equity laws are really, really terrible. And we're getting great support from businesses backing us to push back hard against these things. More, I think, than we've ever seen, and I think that corporate SA has ever done. So I think that's encouraging, and we've got to continue to push in those directions. We've got to continue to be a valuable partner locally for foreign companies who want to understand the policy environment here. And so that they can also adapt and adopt responses to these harmful policies and kind of also start resisting and pushing back. If we get that right, I think we can get some real wins. People have to steel themselves, though, because it's getting into a time of real shaky ground. And this is a time to support good organizations, think clearly,
think realistically, and hold not only politicians to account, but the institutions that are, you know, claiming to be working for people, hold them to account. And I think you know, that's where we are. So it's totally understandable if people are feeling nervous at this point, Bronwyn.
Russell, thanks so much for joining me. Great, engaging. Russell Lamberti is the CEO of Sakalicha.